KALW.
We are in the middle of an unprecedented economic contraction related to the COVID-19 crisis.
The city of Oakland braces itself for the financial impact of the coronavirus.
This is the biggest shortfall we've seen, and over the next 14 months, it will require significant and swift action.
Then we meet a hospital chaplain who taps into COVID patients' faith to help ease the pain.
When I said, "Would you like to pray?" I saw his shoulders relax. And that was a big deal because he was having a hard time breathing.
And the story of the night one musician's life changed forever.
I just remember growing up, if I heard somebody being convicted of murder, I was like, wow, how can you murder somebody? And here I am in a street fight and somebody dies.
That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba and this is Cross Currents. The coronavirus has affected so many areas of our personal lives, including, of course, our finances. State officials say California is projected to have a $54 billion deficit, and the impact is going to hit cities, too. Oakland city officials recently gave a report on the city's budget. It's expected to face the largest financial shortfall in its history. So how will Oakland weather this economic storm? Here with more on this is KALW's East Oakland reporter, Janae Darden. Hey, Janae.
Hey, Hannah.
So Oakland's getting ready for the largest budget shortfall ever. What are they projecting exactly?
They're projecting a shortfall of $122 million in just a little over a year.
Oh, wow.
Bradley Johnson, he's the city's principal budget analyst, and he explained this financial emergency during Mayor Schaaf's weekly town hall meeting on the coronavirus. He says that the projected drop in revenue is sharper and much quicker than the one from the Great Recession in 2008. Mm-hmm. And so right now, Hannah, the city is in the middle of their two-year budget cycle, and it's right around the time that they see if they're on par with the budget. So the mayor is supposed to submit a proposed amended budget to the city council. So the numbers that they initially estimated for the year are probably going to be looking different going forward.
Okay. And then whenever there's a recession, there's cuts. So was there any talk of that?
Well, city services will definitely be affected. Bradley says they're looking into freezing vacant job positions. He says they may, quote, release employees, unquote, whose work can't be provided during quarantine. They may suspend payments to long-term medical and pension costs. Also being considered are furloughs, selling property the city owns, and just, you know, and more.
That's a lot to think about. What did Mayor Libby Schaaf say about these possible changes?
She says that freezing positions will help to prevent layoff of city workers, but warned that vacant positions at rec centers and some civilian positions with the police department may be frozen, too.
So then why these positions in particular?
She says those areas have a lot of vacant positions and they're paid for by the city's general purpose fund. And in fact, more than 76% of city staff pay comes from that fund. Now, Councilwoman Lynette Gibson McElhaney was also part of this town hall, and she's the chair of the city council's finance and management committee. Mm-hmm. And she pushed back on the mayor's suggested cuts to recreational staff because Oakland youth have voiced that they need more safe spaces. And so she says she's going to fight for the youth and she'll have her chance when the mayor submits a proposed budget at the end of the month, which must be approved by the city council.
Ooh, okay. So a looming recession, reductions in city services. What does this all mean for Oakland?
Before the coronavirus, you know, we heard from the media that the country had rebounded from the Great Recession.
Right.
But the cost of living has soared in Oakland, and we have a homeless crisis. The Chronicle reported that Oakland has a poverty rate of 20%, which is 5% more than the national average. And in East Oakland, the median income is $43,000 a year. So to put that in perspective, in Alameda County, a family of four is considered low income if they make under $89,600.
So Oakland is well diverse. Under low income, right?
Yeah, right. Almost close to like less than 90,000, right? You know, I mean, Oakland is diverse and, you know, not just culturally, but economically too. So this will likely hit low income folks, you know, people who are poor and some middle class residents, you know, harder.
So this is a lot. Was there any hopeful news?
So the city learned from the last recession and established a rainy day fund in case the city comes up against a financial downturn like what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. The mayor and city budget analyst Bradley Johnson says that the $31 million in that fund will give the city some cushion. housing, street paving, libraries will not be, quote, dramatically impacted, unquote, because they are paid for by restricted funds, which must be spent on specific resources and services. Federal aid is a possibility. Oakland didn't qualify for funding from the CARES Act because it was for cities with populations over 500,000. But if the federal government gives emergency funds to smaller cities, that could help. They're also looking to aid from state legislation, too. So, you know, there are some bright spots, but they made it very clear, Hana, that challenging days are ahead.
Okay. Thank you for the update, Janae.
Thank you.
Janae Darden is KALW's East Oakland reporter. You can find more of her stories at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Every day, while a lot of us are dealing with homeschooling and boredom, ODing on Netflix and Zoom meetings, there are millions of people in California out there on the front lines, in hospitals and grocery stores, delivering food and packages. We sing for them at night, and our kids post hearts in their windows as a sign of gratitude. These workers are part of a much larger group whose jobs have been deemed essential by the state. And we wanted to share the overlooked stories of people who are putting themselves and their families in harm's way every time they leave their homes. It's all part of a new series we're calling The Essentials. In our first episode, we'll meet a hospital chaplain. Now, in normal times, interfaith chaplains are here to help patients with their spiritual and emotional needs. But in the time of coronavirus, one chaplain says medical workers now are asking for help.
My name's Chaplain Claire Bowman, and I'm the director of Sojourn Chaplaincy. We're the spiritual care department at the San Francisco General Hospital. I'm an interfaith minister. My primary work is in the emergency department and the ICUs. There's a number of us who are in the hospital and visiting with patients and going to the wards. And, you know, if we go into any rooms, we're all following proper PPE protocol like we would do with any patient in isolation. I think learning how to smile at somebody when they can't see your face is something I think we're all learning as a society right now, is how do you smile with your eyes. Part of what we're doing as spiritual care providers in the hospital and as chaplains in the hospital is providing spiritual and emotional support for the frontline staff. I think people are really receptive to care in a way that they haven't been, and I think the staff certainly are receptive to care. So that looks like everything from, a prayer or a blessing for somebody who's coming on to a shift, to some emotional support at the bedside of a challenging situation, to going around and doing grounding exercises and some mindfulness practices at team huddles. We just last week launched our spiritual care warm line, and so this is a line that staff can call to receive chaplain support over the phone, you know, at the beginning of a shift or, you know, after a hard shift, if they just want someone to kind of talk through things with and unload with a little bit before they go home. It can be a rough transition from the hospital to home sometimes. There's a very palpable fear in providing care with an unknown disease, and a disease that we're just learning about. And I think that's a lot of what spirituality has to offer us, is how do we be in the unknown? How do we sit in the mystery, especially when that mystery is painful or scary? And I will say that, I've had more people ask me that question. How do I deal with the unknown? How do I sit in the anxiety of this time? I do what we do as chaplains is, you know, how do you do it? And kind of turn it back around and invite them into a reflective process to help them find the answer that they have within them. COVID is a scary disease. You know, it's a new disease. So I think it's a scary experience to have a disease that there's a lot of unknowns around. And I've had a number of conversations, you know, with folks who were in that fear and, you know, being able to ask, well, have you been able to pray about it? And a patient being like, oh, no, actually, I haven't yet. And so just helping people remember that they have these resources that help get them through this. Oh, there was this one patient who I was talking with through the glass, and he was just really struggling and having a hard time breathing. And when I said, you know, would you like to pray? And we started praying together, and his, you know, I saw his shoulders relax. And, you know, and that was a big deal because he was having a hard time breathing. And so, you know, for his kind of just shoulders to drop and him to just be able to just, you know, as his body dropped and kind of his shoulders dropped, just be able to drop into that, to his faith and drop into his connection with God. It's just really beautiful. You could almost see the healing that was happening in that moment. Serving at the General, I don't know if you know about the history of this hospital or the history of Sojourn, but Sojourn was actually born in the early 1980s when there was a mysterious disease that was killing gay men, and there were religious leaders that were refusing to meet with them because they were gay. And there was an Episcopal priest who said, we got to do something about this. And so she started organizing other clergy and religious leaders and developed the first AIDS ministry training here in the country, actually. And in that time, we trained hundreds, if not thousands, of clergy in how to provide non-judgmental, compassionate care for people who were dying of what we now know as AIDS. And I've been really feeling those ancestors a lot in this work and feeling kind of the wisdom of that time. They all got through it somehow, and just trusting that we will too.
That was Chaplain Claire Bowman, Director of Sojourn Chaplaincy at the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. Her story was produced by KELW's Judy Silber and the Spiritual Edge Project. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we've got a story from the Uncuffed team at San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden, you heard this.
David Jassy is a Grammy-nominated artist and songwriter from Stockholm, Sweden. With a passion for music and a promising career ahead of him, he flew to Hollywood to work with fellow artists. But 6 weeks into his stay, Jassy found himself facing a life sentence in prison. How did Jassy's tale turn from triumph to tragedy so quickly? Greg Eskridge has that story from our San Quentin radio archives.
In the early 1980s, hip-hop music, born in the Bronx, found its way to Sweden and into the living room of young David Jassy.
I got into the hip-hop culture and I started breaking and later on beatboxing. I was inspired by Dougie Fresh and I started experimenting with it and going. And you know, from there I just got a lot of musical ideas just from beatboxing.
Those musical ideas led him to start rapping, and his talent was soon noticed.
I started writing my own songs, and at age 17, I signed my first record deal.
When he was 22, he co-founded a group called The Navigators. The album got heavy rotation on radio and even MTV. Then the song Superstar was dropped and proved to be one of their greatest hits. It would go on to be nominated for a Swedish Grammy.
The Grammy event was a cool experience for us, and it opened up a lot of doors. There she goes, swapping the cold cut of her nose, her approach. She's all about prerogative clothes,
exposed strip shows, posing in the videos. She's an extravaganza, cold dancer. The Navigators began traveling all over the world. Eventually, the group was split up, but Jossie says that opened up new opportunities, like being featured on a song with Ashley Tisdale called Be Good to Me. The song was a huge success, making it to number 5 on the Billboard charts. What up, mommy, what it is, what's good? I'll make you shine like a star up in Hollywood. I'll be your knight in shining armor, your prince in the saga. Never catching me bringing drama, never that. Whoa, you want a club like Monopoly. Curves looking like you want the DNA lottery. And I'ma be good like water to a whale. Jazzy world, Miss Ashley Tisdale.
The people from Warner Brothers liked what I did, so they called me up and asked me if I wanted to work with Ashley Tisdale and a couple of other acts.
Jossie accepted the invitation and boarded a flight to Los Angeles.
Ever since I started doing music, my dream was always to become this great rap star or, you know, great music star in America. That was always a big dream for me.
But after only 6 weeks in Los Angeles, one night changed the course of his life forever.
My friends were, you know, in the living room partying and wanted to go out. I really didn't feel like going out, but somehow I did. And that night, we went out to this club. And when me and my girlfriend left the club, this guy started beating on my car, and unfortunately, I made the wrong decision and got out the car, and we got into a fight.
His decision to get out of the car would prove fatal. The following day, Jossie was arrested and informed that the man he had a fist fight with had died. Jossie was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to 15 years to life in 2010.
It was a shock in so many ways. Your brain just goes numb. And then at the same time, I'm dealing with the fact that somebody died and that I was responsible for it. So there's a lot of emotions going through myself, and it's almost like an out-of-body experience.
Adjusting to prison life was a challenge for Jossie, and he is constantly reminded of what his life used to be. One day, for example, he saw Pyramid, a song he had written for a new artist, be performed on television.
That's one of the moments I wish I was right there, you know, doing what I'm supposed to do, music.
After transferring to San Quentin in 2013, Jossie would get the opportunity to get back to create music.
SQPR, San Quentin Prison Report.
Being able to create music again has been therapeutic for Jossie.
As of now, I'm working on writing songs and producing them, writing new compositions and adding music scores to video and radio interviews. So it's truly a blessing to be here at San Quentin and have that opportunity to get back to doing what I used to do, which is music, which I also love to do.
However, not a day goes by where he doesn't think about his crime.
It breaks my heart every single day to know that I'm responsible for taking another man's life, And for his family not being able to see him is really heartbreaking, and it's hard on myself. I just remember growing up, if I heard somebody being convicted of murder, I was like, wow, how can you murder somebody? And here I am in a street fight and somebody dies, you know? That's something I could never imagine myself, you know, ever being convicted of murder.
The reality of his situation shows him how fragile life is. One day, he's in a studio writing songs for up-and-coming artists. Then the next day, he's sitting in a prison cell. He hopes others can learn from his story.
Even though you think it's just a fist fight, people can actually die from it. And it turns into something so devastating after he loses his life. And how many people actually get affected by this, I think that's something a lot of people don't think about, you know, to see what your actions can actually do. It just humbles you as a human being, you know. It's just like, wow, what was I doing? What was I thinking? How could I not see this coming, you know? And I don't think anyone can.
I'm Greg Eskridge, reporting for SQPR.
That was Greg Eskridge, a producer for Uncuffed at San Quentin Radio. David Jassy was granted clemency by Governor Newsom in March of this year, and on April 7th, he was released after 11 years of incarceration and returned to Sweden, where he's living now. KALW's radio training program at San Quentin Prison is supported by the California Arts Council with funding from the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. You can listen to more stories from Uncuffed at our website, kalw.org/uncuffed. Tune in tomorrow at 5. A bar mitzvah celebration goes virtual and a plan to gather and grieve is put on hold.
The tears were for everything. They were for my dad, for how hard it had been to get to that moment and how we pulled it through and we were awesome. How we supported each other.
Mourning and celebrating during the coronavirus pandemic. That's tomorrow at 5. Today's Cross Currents team includes Sona Avakian, Christopher Agusa, Nina Gensler-Debs, True Quinn, Andrew Stelzer, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.